Well, hello everyone, and welcome. I'm here. Now, recently I was watching a video, an appearance on a channel by Scott Ritter. And, Scott Ritter, he's kind of a more emotional voice. I'd kind of stopped listening to him, but obviously recently Ukraine has been back in the news. The fallout has been dramatic, and I've been following things pretty closely. So I'd started listening to Ritter again. Well, he launched it into this extraordinary rant where he basically claimed that since the rumble in the White House, now Britain, Europe, and Zelensky and so on are all enemies of America. Let me just play you the clip, and then I will bring some other material to bear. In fact, a very interesting book by a man called John Biggs Davison. But anyway, let's listen to what Scott Ritter had to say.
And he actively advocated for the victory of the Biden administration, basically saying that Donald Trump was a threat. I don't know if you know anything about Donald Trump, but he has an ego, he has thin skin, and he's vindictive as hell, and his memory's like an elephant. You think he's going to forget that? The West may have forgotten that. The media may have ignored it. Donald Trump hasn't forgotten that, as obvious, as made obvious by J.D. Vance's bringing it up. But it wasn't just that. After his November election, Zelensky, NATO, the European Union all conspired with the Biden administration to Trump-proof their policies. That's straight up saying that they are conspiring against the president of the United States. Even though Biden was the president, we know who was going to be president. We know what their policies are. So if you're trying to Trump-proof it, you're saying that you're advocating in direct opposition to the policy direction that Donald Trump wants to take America. In short, you've become the enemy of America. So now that we've simplified it, Zelensky is the enemy of America. Ukraine is the enemy of America. Great Britain is the enemy of America. Keir Starmer is the enemy of America. France, Macron, they are the enemy of America. Europe is the enemy of America. NATO is the enemy of America.
So, initially, if you want to respond emotionally, I think a lot of people's instinct would be to say, oh, Ritter's a blowhard, to call him names, to bring up some dodgy things in his past, say he's a Russian agent, all of these sorts of things. And on one level, there is an extent to which you could have that, gutting, instinctual, almost boomer level response to what he was saying. But that is not the response I had. I was immediately put in mind of two writers who I've talked about quite a lot on this channel, Julius Evola in the top right there, and Francis Parker Yockey. In fact, him saying Europe is the enemy of America directly reminded me of a book by Yockey called The Enemy of Europe. You can see a recent edition edited by Greg Johnson there. And of course, Evola's essays on America. There's one called American Civilization. Another more notorious essay you can find in this book here, The Bow in the Club, is called Negrified America. And basically, the Evola thesis and the Yockey thesis is that Europe is caught between two anti-traditional powers, two anti-European powers, two non-European powers, namely America and Europe. Now, what interested me is that this is the first time I can remember where a reasonably prominent American, one who likes Russia quite a lot, Scott Ritter, was talking in this way about Europe. And certainly I've noticed on Twitter, whether it's an operation or, some sort of psyop or whatever, an increased number of attacks from Americans on Europeans on Twitter. So this question has kind of come up again. Now, I have a book here called The Uncertain Ally by the man that you can see in the bottom right, who was an MP for many years, in fact, John Biggs Davison. He was a Tory MP, and at one point he was the chairman of a right-wing group known as the Monday Club, which was the kind of rightist vanguard within the Tory party. And he was an MP all the way up until 1988, I believe. So he kind of went all the way into the Thatcher era, even though, as you'll hear, he was a staunch opponent of laissez-faire and of, you know, classical liberalism and so on. This guy was a proper old-fashioned Tory, not a Tory boy, like a proper Tory. Now, before I'm going to read quite a lengthy extract from this book, about 20 pages or so. So before I do so, strap in comfortably, friends. Maybe pick up a course at the academic agency. I'm going to play my Foundations of Shakespeare ad, but you can pick up the Trivium and many other courses. Buy it now. And when I come back, I'm going to be reading a couple of chapters from this incredibly difficult to find book, The Uncertain Ally by John Biggs Davison.
Who was Shakespeare? What if everything you have been taught about Shakespeare is wrong? What you need is a non-woke university-level Shakespeare course based on solid scholarship, stripping out all recent nonsense since 1980. A comprehensive introduction to studying Shakespeare, featuring 14 lectures and covering 8 major plays. A Midsummer Night's Dream, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, Measure for Measure, Hamlet, Othello, King Lear, and Macbeth. Foundations of Shakespeare. Buy it now from the Academic Agency.
All right. So, yeah, John Biggs Davison, Uncertain Ally. Now, I'm going to start reading here, and I'm going to read more than I would usually, because the second chapter, the first chapter is about America and Russia, and it's called The Giants. Right, he's writing this book in 1957, just after the Suez Crisis and the fall of Anthony Eden. And then the second chapter is called A World of Empires. Now, the reason I'm reading both of these is that the second chapter ties in to a theme in my recent videos, which is the decline of empire, and specifically the relationship between tariffs, protectionism, free trade, and empire. I think we're starting to see like some similar things that have happened to America, as I've been talking about on my Monday videos. But anyway, without further ado, I'm going to start, and I'm going to try to keep my interruptions to a minimum, because this is quite a lengthy extract. In March 1917, the outbreak of the Russian Revolution raised false hopes in a Germany fighting on two fronts, for the mastery of Europe and her survival as an empire. Shortly afterwards, 5 American merchantmen were sunk by German Unterseebooten. Neutrality had been the pride, the virtue, and the traditional policy of the United States. Belligerency now became a virtue and a necessity, and the debt of Lafayette could be repaid in France. On April the 2nd, President Woodrow Wilson read his war message to Congress. "It is a fearful thing to lead this great peaceful people into war, but the right is more precious than peace, and we shall fight for the things which we have always carried nearest our hearts, for democracy, for the right of those who submit to authority to have a voice in their own governments, for the rights and liberties of small nations, for a universal dominion of right by such a concert of free peoples as shall bring peace and safety to all nations and make the world itself at last free. The world must be made safe for democracy. Its peace must be planted on the foundations of political liberty." End quotation. That was Woodrow Wilson. A cynic might say that if such the principles at stake in the Great War, they had been at stake since 1914, the lawless and imprudent sinking of American ships and the menace of a European continent subjugated by Germany impelled the United States to take its place in the line of battle. But professions of abstract principle, gilded with a certain contempt for purely national considerations, are part of the ritual of democracy at war. democracy fights in anger and righteousness, and the wars of people are more horrible than those of kings. That is, the wars of peoples are more horrible than those of kings. Very astute point from Biggs Davison. They are the religious wars of an irreligious age, fought in the faith that everyone will be better off after the war, that there will be more wealth to share, not less. And that, despite the facts of original sin, power, nationality, history, and economics, universal remedies will be found for the ills of the whole world. In peacetime, democracies underestimate the necessity of arms. In time of war, they overestimate what arms can achieve. As revolutionary Russia slipped from the struggle, the American intervention became decisive. At first, the United States forces used French artillery and British aeroplanes and rifles. But Wilson's friend, Mr. Bernard Baruch, suggest you read about him, friends, in your own time. A certain car manufacturer had a great deal to say about him in a famous book. Organized a vast munitions production, and American men, money, and potential tilted the scales finally against the Central Powers. Ruin awaited the ancient Habsburg and the parvenu Hohenzollern empires alike. Russia was being carried in the grip of revolution through a provisional liberalism and through anarchy to its Bolshevik destination. England and France were drained of treasure and blood. For more than half a century, the British fleet had shielded the growing American giant. Free trade had nourished him with capital and strengthened him with children that might otherwise have advanced the Empire of England. Now he stood forth a world power. Fresh, vigorous, enriched, and unscarred, the United States could claim a major share in the future settlement. The Allies, who had borne the burden of the war, were tainted and tarnished with the diplomacy of expediency. America, an associated and not an allied power, possessed a president who was high-principled and uncompromised. In 1914, the foreign debt of the United States amounted to some $1,000 million. In 1918, they were the great creditors of the indebted Allies. I'll just say, by the way, that this prose style, this kind of old empire dude writing in the 1950s prose style, is my favorite form of English prose. I just think these guys write so well. A lot of the books I share have this style. Major General Richard Hilton's another one. John Bagot Glubb. I just love the style of this sort of character in the 1950s. Anyway, I'll continue. On January the 8th, 1918, Mr. Woodrow Wilson delivered to Congress a statement of the war aims and peace terms of the United States. The third of these 14 points declared for, quote, the removal so far as possible of all economic barriers and the establishment of an equality of trade conditions among all the nations consenting to the peace and associating themselves for its maintenance. President Wilson wished America to play a leading part in the League of Nations and to provide a guarantee against further German aggression. He failed. America was a great power. A world war had been fought, but isolationism was a mighty influence. Normalcy spoke louder to the American public than the accents of militant international idealism. To the east of Europe, also a great power, withdrew into isolation. The ideals of Wilson and of Lenin, alike subversive of foreign empires, flowed into a drained and weary Europe. Both the liberal Democrat and the Marxist dictator denounced the methods of traditional diplomacy and propounded a new order. In 1920, Wilson was defeated by his countrymen. Lenin was beaten back from the gates of Warsaw. Two new world powers had revealed themselves. They had not yet come forward as contestants for universal primacy. That time came with the Second World War. Since then, a company of states has trembled or sought refuge in their shadow. A multitude of struggling and debtor countries has been hemmed between an iron curtain and a tariff wall. The United States of America and the Union of Socialist Soviet Republics are thought of as poles apart. Nevertheless, they have features in common. And this is where this started to get really interesting, because Biggs Davison here in this next passage basically echoes things that Evola says, things that Yockey says. Okay, remember, Yockey was an American, Evola was an Italian, Biggs Davison was a Brit. Okay, but they're all pointing out very similar things. Okay, listen to this next passage. These two continental masses, inhabited by a variety of races of differing cultures and nations, both enjoy a large measure of economic self-sufficiency, rich mines, productive labor camps, vast prairie corn lands. The Union, the American Union, and the Soviet Union both derive their institutions from the revolutionary rejection of an old order. I'll read that sentence again. The American Union and the Soviet Union both derive their institutions from the revolutionary rejection of an older order. Englishmen may think of the American War of Independence. For Americans, it is their revolution. True, it was led by Whiggish gentlemen of the 18th century. The October Revolution was plotted and performed by atheist intellectuals of the present savage century. But in both revolutions, hereditary monarchy and hereditary privilege were trampled down and organized religion separated from the state, rigidly in the one, in the other with ruthless cold savagery and opportunism. Both the USA and the USSR are multiracial federations, having a written constitution which distributes powers between the states and the center. Stalin, like the founding fathers, provided two central elective chambers, one of which represented each of the units of the federation. Members of the USSR have the right of secession, but that is merely the theory of the constitution. In America, Lincoln went to war to prevent the secession of the southern states. In both countries, a Georgia felt the weight of federal anger. Neat parallelism by Biggs Davison here. What the ocean was to the adventurers of England, the steppes and the prairies were to the Russians and the Americans. Under Tsar and President alike, the imperialism of governments lagged behind the enterprise of adventurers. Old believers and Mormons played a similar part. The Cossack and the plainsman each symbolized the tradition of the open and mobile frontier. The recent history, both of the USA and the USSR, is of the taming of the wilderness, of bewildering technological advance. American efficiency and productive energy are admired in Russia. The new University of Moscow is a skyscraper of 30 stories, copied from the Rockefeller Center. The ordinary Russian seemed to General Eisenhower to bear a marked similarity to what we call an average American. In 1942, Mr. Wendell Willkie flew round the world and visited the Republic of Yakutsk. Our hotel, the only hotel in Yakutsk, was a new building made of logs with a Russian stove in every room. It was filled with tough-looking men in leather coats and boots made of reindeer fur. The girls were red-cheeked, with handkerchiefs tied around their heads. The town itself seemed in many ways like a Western town in America a generation ago. In fact, much of this life reminded me of our own early days and expanding days, especially the hearty, simple tastes, the not-too-subtle attitudes of mind, the tremendous vitality. The pavements along the bigger streets were boardwalks, like I remember in Elwood when I was a boy. He's still quoting this guy, Wendell Willkie. The houses had the neat, buttoned-up look of homes in any northern town, with light from the windows and soft smoke coming from the chimneys. There were many contrasts between Serbia and Minnesota or Wisconsin, but Muratov, who ran the Republic, was a man who would do well in America. His way of doing things, like the Soviet way all over Siberia, is rough and tough and often cruel and sometimes mistaken. But when Muratov spoke of the economic development of Yakutsk, he talked like a Californian real estate salesman, said Mr. Wilkie, who was reminded of the robust days at the beginning of the American century, when our own leaders were chiefly interested in getting things done. Think of it, Mr. Wilkie, 160 harvesters at the Arctic Circle. These people have developed an enthusiasm and self-confidence which reminded me repeatedly of the romance of our own Western development. Whether or not the October Revolution has reached its thermidor, the United States, like other countries, the Western world is becoming more socialistic. This is Big Stavison again. Russia remains totalitarian. American is egalitarian rather than liberal in sentiment. That America is egalitarian rather than liberal in sentiment. Very interesting from Big Stavison. Great disparities of wealth exist in both. In both, the social ideal might be described as bourgeois and conformist. Now, this is also interesting because if you read Evola's critiques of America, especially those two essays I mentioned, Negrified America and American Civilization, Evola is always coming back to the conformist nature of the typical American, okay? The bourgeois nature of the American. Yockey makes many similar points, of course, although Americans may think of him as a self-hating American, something like that. I don't know. In all human societies, ideas and theories lag behind facts and events, and orthodox Marxism-Bolshevism may go the way of the rugged individualism of American history and myth. Free enterprise remains the pride and basis of the United States economy, but the New Deal and the Fair Deal have made deep inroads into the preserves of private capitalism. The labor unions have grown very great, and wealth pays a heavy ransom in taxation and social measures. National agencies and international bodies, dominated by the United States, have assumed many of the functions formerly performed by private capital and finance. More than elsewhere, wrote André Siegfried, and incidentally, this is a quotation from a book called The Character of Peoples by this writer, André Siegfried. I was tremendously interested by the title of this book and immediately bought the only copy on Amazon. So there may be well be a video on this book coming up soon, because it's a book where he asks, what is the character of different nations? Is there such a thing? And if so, you know, how do we characterize each nation? Anyway, this is what he has to say about America. More than elsewhere, wrote Siegfried, society in America is a man society, and it is in this very man that its economic lies strength. The pursuit of efficiency leads down the same collectivist slope in Pittsburgh as it does in Magnitogorsk. Sorry about my Russian pronunciation. Magnitogorsk. I need Alexander Mercurius here to help me. Sometimes, and in various measure, Russia turns her face towards Europe, but the USSR is a non-European power, right? Big Stavison flatly asserting the USSR is a non-European power. The United States, planted from Great Britain and from Europe, has in the process of assimilating its children become a new civilization distinct from those of the old world and of that empire, whose heart, to quote Mr. Robert Sencourt, touches Europe and shares its soul. The United States revolted against the old civilization of the old world, and from the American quote-unquote melting pot has arisen a new cosmopolis influenced by Europe, but different and distinct. The system and concept of federation common to both is adaptable to expansion and to universal empire. As the American Union extended itself across the Alleghenies and its heroes and adventures mannered a moving frontier, territories were annexed and grew into states. It is a process or an aspiration which the ocean has not halted. Atlantic and Pacific communities linked through Washington are aims of United States foreign policy, perceived consistently whether it is a Republican or a Democrat in the White House. One World, which is the title of Mr. Wilkie's book, is the aim both of the liberal internationalist in America and of the international communist in the Soviet Union. So that was the end of chapter one. Very interesting parallels between America and Russia. And basically what Biggs Davison argues in this book, The Uncertain Ally, is that American strategy from 1917 to 1957 was one of continually undermining the British Empire in order to supplant the old way of doing things with this new liberal internationalist order that he's talking about. So this brings us on to chapter two, A World of Empires. Empires are made by interests and ideals. The emissary, as well as the merchant, the soldier, the explorer, and administrator, are symbols of imperialism. By imperialism, we mean the extension of the influence of a great power over weaker or more backward territories or peoples, whether across a continent or across the seven seas, over salt water or fresh, whether Indians or Red Indians are subdued, Zulus or Uzbeks. Brilliant writing, I love it. Undaunted by the humiliation of Yorktown, the British in the 19th century founded a second empire. The European powers scrambled for Africa. Russia in Asia presented a recurrent threat to British interests in the Straits, the Persian Gulf, or India itself, early in the century, to American pioneers on the Pacific coast. Between the French Revolution and the American Civil War, Russia acquired territories equal to the whole European Empire before that time. Her whole European Empire before that time. Resisted, Russia receded. For, as Lord Palmerston told the House of Commons in 1860, and I thought this was a very interesting quotation given the current world situation, Palmerston wrote, "It has always been the practice of the Russian government to expand its frontiers as rapidly as the apathy or timidity of neighbouring states would permit, but usually to halt and frequently to recoil when confronted by determined opposition." Right, that was Palmerston in 1860. Now, given that the British establishment has been thinking in this way towards Russia all the way back to Palmerston there in 1860, maybe this explains the reason for the British strategy now. And it's kind of, in my view, ludicrous opposition to Russia in the present day. I say ludicrous, of course, because Britain just simply does not have the power that it did in 1860 to be that force of resistance. We just don't, you know, part of realism is assessing the, you know, the power differentials and concluding, well, yeah, maybe it's better we don't get into this one because we're not going to win, you know. Certainly that's my assessment. Anyway, let's continue. Beyond Russia, American zeal for trade aroused Japan from out of sleep. In 1895, the Japanese Empire reached beyond the homeland islands. The Russian bear padded forward with caution across the spaces of Asia. It had no occasion to take the sea. Not till the close of the century did the American eagle take wing across the broad waters. Again, beautiful prose. I just love it. But only ignorance could believe or hypocrisy claim that Russia and the United States are not and were not imperialist powers. There were turbulent colonists in 1775 who spoke of an American great empire. While Europe sank into the slough of slavery, a new civilization founded upon liberty was to be erected upon the illimitable continent, measureless in its resources. Parted from the English crown, the United States of America gained by treaty, purchase and conquest, hegemony from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. The methods and motives of American expansion, noble and ignoble, mercenary and idealistic, resembled those of the empires of the old war. broken treaties were not peculiar to Europe. The history of Texas recalls that of the Transvaal. Nevertheless, Americans persevered in their hatred of more formal and traditional empires. Ancestral memories of colonial revolt were kept alive by the more recent memories of European immigrants. The wretched refuse from the teeming shores of the bad old world, who, freed from effete kingship and prescriptive inequality, rejoice to quote-unquote breathe free the bracing air of American liberty. The American Empire and the Second British Empire grew up together under the protection of a tacit and one-sided alliance. Now, that this analysis in the next two pages here greatly interests me because it basically echoes what I have long believed, that the introduction of laissez-faire led directly to the fall of the British Empire. I've never seen anyone else quite argue it as directly as Biggs Davison here. And it's good to know, basically, that my own instincts are actually being echoed by a much wiser man writing 80-odd years ago. So anyway, let's carry on. Canning helped to formulate the British Navy guaranteed the Monroe Doctrine. Canning suspected that the ban upon colonization and interference was a warning against British encroachment upon the Oregon country. But without British support and the British interests in the Latin American trade, the United States alone could not have assured the continued independence of the liberated Spanish possessions. England, in Canning's day, was protectionist, but the ideas of laissez-faire and the devil take the hindmost were soon to be imposed upon the body politic. These immoral and pernicious fallacies were not perceived of by medieval Englishmen and were alien to the paternal practice of English monarchy in the Middle Ages. Wool backed by the sceptre founded our commercial superiority, and the Lord Chancellor sits on a woolsack to this day. Tudor and Stuart sovereigns contrived to form a welfare state to replace the ravaged welfare church. The Navigation Acts of 1651 and 1680 and the Methuen Treaty of 1703 secured favourable treatment for British seamen and shipping and for British trade. Adam Smith's German disciple Friedrich List well said, I'm not sure how much of a Smith disciple List was, by the way, but anyway, this is a good quote from List. List well said that from every country of the continent, this island borrowed its peculiar aptitudes and planted them under the shelter of her tariffs upon her own soil. England's early imperial conception was of a protective system under which the motherland exchanged her manufactures with the tropical and other colonial produce which could not be grown at home. Edmund Burke tells us that between 1702 and 1777, British exports to the colonies increased from £500,000 to £5 million. The Canadian friends, listen to this next bit because there's a good bit of Canada detail here that may interest you. The Canadian lumber industry owes its rise to prosperity to a preference granted in 1807. Between Waterloo and 1840, 532,000 British emigrants entered Canada and only 458,000 the United States. In 1815, Great Britain was not only the leader of the victorious coalition, but the leader of the world in industry, commerce, and finance. The Industrial Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars brought England suffering and a supremacy which was the result not of accident, but of a deliberate and intelligent national and imperial policy. Okay, and Biggs Davison here is attacking the idea of the accidental empire, basically saying nothing about it was an accident at all. This was policy. It was imperial policy. In the years which followed, Huskisson and Peel transformed our monopoly of trade with the colonies into something better, a moderate system of tariff preferences. But Peel did not stop there. He surrendered the Tory cause and the national future to the errors and spirit of the age. The cold and callous doctrines of laissez-faire now dominated the manufacturing interest. Factory owners believed that free trade would permit low wages, allay the discontent which accompanied bad harvests and trade depression, and spiked the squires into the bargain. In a time of great distress, their arguments were persuasive. As Disraeli's Lord Roehampton put it in Endymion, what cry can be better than that of cheap bread? It gives one an appetite at once. From the defection of Sir Robert Peel in 1848, we can trace the long, slow, sad decline in the fortunes of England. He's talking about the repeal of the Corn Laws, of course. The gradual abandonment of the corn duties did not even have much real effect on the price of wheat, which first fell drastically in the late 70s when American prairie wheat, ruthlessly cultivated, I'm guessing he's talking about the use of slavery, filled our rapacious urban markets and devastated British agriculture. It is true that industrial recovery followed within 3 years of the abolition of the Corn Laws, but it was a case of post hoc, not propter hoc. The depression was lifted by the discovery of gold in California and Australia. British merchants controlled the Australian and Californian trade, and by the voriferous European and American demand for railways, which England alone could build. As the corn duties were slowly extinguished, the colonial preference system was gradually abandoned, and the ruin not only of British agriculture, but of Britain's industrial lead was prepared. Absolutely crucial point. Britain threw away its industrial advantage because of laissez-faire, is what he's arguing. I have long believed this myself. Canada was thrown, not for the last time, into the American lap, as if, to quote Governor Elgin, to make the Canadians feel more bitterly how much kinder England is to the children who desert her than to those who remain faithful. And this is a bit of a sore point with Canadians, because one of the things I've learnt about Canadians, both through my buddy Black Horse and Mike from Imperium Press, is that they were always empire loyalists. They were always loyal to the centre. And, you know, they were loyal to the British Empire, and now they've been loyal to American Empire. And they take, like, betrayal really badly. It's kind of, you know, it's the flip side of the Canadian character. They try to be, you know, more true to the empire than the empire itself, in a way. She lost not only Peel's shilling preference, her bushel of wheat, but preference for her timber. The Baltic producers benefited at Canada's expense. So what Biggs Davison is saying is that laissez-faire, basically, the policy of the British Empire in this period, hurt Canadian timber industry, basically. The British government offered amends by negotiating with the United States the reciprocity, and it's the reason that's interesting is that right now we're seeing this dispute, this trade dispute between the American Empire and Canada. And on Wednesday, the Black Horse has an absolutely amazing video, which you must watch, on exactly this this topic. Anyway, let's continue. The British government offered amends by negotiating with the United States the reciprocity treaty of 1854. Reciprocity treaty of 1854. This linked the economy of British North America with that of the adjacent states of the Republic. In 1859, the province of Canada adopted a higher protective tariff against British manufacturers and put it into operation, despite the protesting merchants of Sheffield and the indignation of the very men who had destroyed colonial preference. So look at that. They destroyed colonial preference, and now the British Empire and Canada are engaged in basically a tariff war, right? History doesn't repeat, it rhymes. It's really interesting. The Whigs were also determined to cheapen sugar. of which the working classes were consuming more and more. And in the year of the Reciprocity Treaty was concluded, Gladstone deprived the British West Indies of their preference and reduced them to despair. So Gladstone now, because of quote unquote free trade, is putting the West Indies and the colonies that were built on sugar into destitution. Only the general rise of prices in the 60s saved them from complete collapse. And if you're interested, by the way, there are some really interesting videos on here on YouTube on the history of the sugar trade in the West Indies. It's a brutal, brutal history. Absolutely fascinating. Anyway, let's continue. Cobden denounced colonies as part of a bad old order. With the army, the navy, the church, and the corn laws, they were merely accessories of our aristocratic government. Free trade should purge these, quote, impurities from the constitution. They belong to the discredited mercantile system and should be buried with it. In 1860, Cobden's free trade treaty with France mutilated the promising wine industry of the Cape and sowed some of the seeds of the Boer War. The effect of the Whig repeal of the Navigation Act in 1849 was lessened by the concealed subsidy of the Royal Mail contracts. The empire survived. Ties of kinship, sentiment, and tradition endured. Loyalty is not merely a question of material gain. The colonies depended, moreover, for their defense upon the mother country. They were more helpless because the mother country's unnatural perversity denied them the wealth and opportunity to make a substantial contribution of arms and men. But the empire was no longer a partnership in progress and prosperity. Note what happened here. Despite the fact that the Britain, UK, was screwing over its colonies, including Canada, including the West Indies, they stayed loyal. Okay. Exactly as we're seeing now, despite the fact that America is screwing over Europe, the European vassal is remaining loyal as we speak. But of course, this is a short run thing. It can only last for so long. Let's continue. When in 1887, the Australian statesman Alfred Deakin met John Bright in London, he complained that the mother country, instead of treating the colonies like children, put them on the same footing in her markets as enemies and rivals. For a fleeting period of illusion, free trade was the glory of British capitalists and political economists. Its appeal was less in nations seeking to emulate their success. In the United States, the supremacy of the Northern interests victorious in the Civil War promoted an increase of protective duties. Protection is the law of survival and solvency for weaker and undeveloped powers. American power owes much to American tariffs. And this is stuff I've said in previous videos on US empire and tariffs. Between 1845 and 1875, Great Britain produced more iron and steel, textile, and other manufacturers than all the rest of the world. At the end of the war, between the states, we were masters of the world shipping. We were the creditors of a world which paid for their British imports partly in goods and partly in the manner of international commerce by defaulting upon their loans floated in London. But this prosperity could not last, for, as Disraeli said, the rulers of England believed they could fight hostile tariffs with free imports. In the Great Depression of the 1870s, Germany, France, and other continental states raised their industrial and agricultural tariffs. Bismarck was a student of Frederick List, and in protection, he saw a means to military and imperial power based upon a flourishing agriculture, source of sturdy recruits, upon strategic railways, guaranteed loans, and expanding munitions production and advanced social legislation. British processes developed German iron ore and German dyes behind a screen of protective duties. The supremacy of British iron and steel was challenged. In 1892, Lord Salisbury referred in a speech to the tariff walls encircling the new industrial states. Farah Eckroyd's fair trade movement had evoked a response in Lancashire, but little in the Carlton Club. The Conservative Party was still intellectually subservient to the great liberal heresy. The High McKinley tariff in the United States was described by George Wyndham as, quote, a perfect modern equivalent to Spain's claim in the 16th century to the Spanish Main and all the Indies. Elizabeth met that by encouraging Drake and his companions to cross the line and plunder Philip's ships, talking about the privateers. Unless we are willing to meet the modern equivalent with a modern rejoinder, we must ultimately starve. It was unreal to think of the 8 hours bill or other reforms without considering foreign competition. The man who believes that the American artisan or the French small proprietor will ever give up protection so long as it makes the first rich and saves the second from starvation is unfit for public life. George Wyndham said all of that. Despite such warnings, the Conservative Party did not find it politic or practicable to launch themselves upon the dangerous waters of tariff reform. The initiative came from the self-governing colonies and from a Birmingham radical turned liberal unionist by the Gladstone policy of Irish Home Rule. In 1894, the first Ottawa Conference of the Empire voted for imperial preference. The only dissidents were Great Britain and New South Wales. Next year, New Zealand exchanged reciprocal preferences with South Australia and Canada. Right, so look, the colonies voted for imperial preference even despite what Britain wanted in 1894. Amazing. In 1897, another colonial conference was held in London on the occasion of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. Upon the assistance of the Canadian Premier, Sir Wilfrid Laurier, Lord Salisbury abrogated the commercial treaties concluded in 1864 with the North German Zollverein, that's the customs union, and with Belgium, which the colonies unanimously and urgently denounced at the conference. Those treaties, contrary to earlier practice, had extended the purview of the most favoured national clause to cover not only British trade with any other foreign country, but British trade with the colonies. France, be it noted, pursued no such policy. Indeed, it was to counter the colonial economic views of France that the Congo Free State was set up under international auspices. It was not annexed to Belgium until 1908. The Congo Basin Treaties of 1885 were restrictions whose restrictions were reaffirmed after the Great War at Saint-Germain-en-Laye, carried on the process by imposing the open door on British, French, Portuguese, Belgian, German, and independent Central African territories occupying more than 1 million square miles between the Nile and the Zambezi, the Indian Ocean, and the Atlantic. Similarly, the Anglo-Dutch Convention of 1871 prevented the Gold Coast from giving preference to British over Netherlands goods. And that's interesting because we were watching on a recent reviewing Adam Curtis, weren't we? Some footage, we were wondering about some of the history of the Congo. Well, this explains what was going on there. In 1898, the Dominion of Canada set the Empire an example by granting substantial preferences to imports from the United Kingdom. It was the year of the Spanish-American War. While Joe pleaded the cause of imperial preference for imperial unity, in spite of the sacred teachings of Manchester, the new imperialism was making converts in the United States. In both countries, there were determined and influential opponents of annexations, and Mr. George F. Kennan regrets that the American acquisition of territories from motives of self-interest in Cuba, American investment amounted in 1896 to $50 million, an American trade to twice that should have been unredeemed by a willingness to shoulder for long the white man's burden. Nevertheless, here in 1898, for the first time, territories were acquired which were not expected to gain statehood at all at any time, but rather to remain indefinitely in a status of colonial subordination. White Law Reed often expressed his anxiety lest people might think of the new territories as candidates for statehood, because he knew that, if they did, they would be less inclined to take them in. But what was the alternative? The Cubans, rescued from Spain by the United States, were hardly fit for self-rule, even if there had been a chance for their being let alone by other powers, which there were not. The alternative to our taking them would probably have been a tussle between England and Germany over their possession, but with a reasonable likelihood that some sort of modus vivendi and division of territory would eventually have resulted. Sooner or later, the Japanese would have become competitors for their possession. This is all canon, by the way, talking about the justification for America annexing Cuba. Whether this would have been unfortunate from the standpoint of later developments in the Southwest Pacific, I cannot say. The historian's power fails before such speculative questions. In 1898, the United States forces occupied not only Cuba, but Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines, and the Hawaiian Islands. The new territories were brought behind the United States tariff. In 1899, the United States proclaimed the open door and the integrity of China. President McKinley believed in America's manifest destiny. The expression was not his. It went back to the days of President Polk, carried Old Glory to the farther sea. It was heard in Lincoln's day, when Secretary Seward aroused the enthusiasm of his hearers by proclaiming an American empire which, with its capital in the ancient Aztec metropolis of Mexico City, would stretch from the Arctic to Tierra del Fuego. Seward warned the troops of Napoleon III from Mexico and concluded the purchase of Alaska from Russia. He was an imperialist of energy and vision. He predicted that the American empire would come to grips with the Russian empire in the Far East, in regions where civilization first began. To McKinley succeeded Theodore Roosevelt, who believed in speaking softly and carrying a big stick. Under his genial eye, the Philippines were subjugated and became, quote-unquote, incorporated territory. The Hay-Pungkefort Treaty of 1901 between England and the United States gave the Americans the right to make, hold, and police a ship canal across the Isthmus of Panama. Teddy Roosevelt then engineered a subtle equivalent of the bombardment of Alexandria. American intervention enabled a revolution to bring an independent Republic of Panama into being on Colombian soil. Isn't it amazing? All these same things coming back up under Trump. Panama Canal, anyone? The Venezuelan dispute of 1902 involved European powers. The president invoked the Monroe Doctrine and added the Roosevelt Corollary. This mentioned circumstances in which the United States might be reluctantly compelled in flagrant crisis of war-doing or impotence in the Western Hemisphere to the exercise of an international police power. For a few years, Republican policy in the United States was openly and proudly imperialistic. There was an American response to Joseph Chamberlain's gesture of British friendship. In the mutual recognition of special responsibilities and imperial interests lay an opportunity of Anglo-American friendship. But the succeeding Democrat regime in the United States recoiled from the idea of empire. In 1913, President Woodrow Wilson declared that the United States would not attempt to acquire another foot of territory in Latin America. Henceforth, United States imperialism would advance under an anti-colonial banner. Finance, wherever possible, would take the place of force. Yet Speaker Clay was right when he declared in 1818 that whatever the forms of government in Spanish America, these governments will be animated by an American feeling and guided by an American policy. Meanwhile, despite the efforts of the Tariff Reform League, free trade Britain continued to decline. Her tobacco or her carrying trade might be captured by the Americans, but the operations of the city and other invisible exports mitigated the effect of alien competition. In the early 1870s, that is, Great Britain exported nearly two-thirds of all the exports of Finnish manufacturers in the world. By 1913, she had been outstripped in industrial production by Germany and still more by the United States, and her share of the world's exports had fallen from two-thirds to just one-third. Yet despite a visible adverse balance of £158 million, she had a net credit balance of payments of £181 million, or more than a sixth of the existing monetary gold. It was still possible to drift. The brightest feature of her economic position was the remarkable effect of the one-sided preference given the United Kingdom by the Empire overseas. The change was most remarkable in Canada, with its keen competitor across the 49th parallel. During the 5 years before 1897, our exports to Canada had fallen from £6.87 million to £5.172 million. The next 5 years showed an increase to £10.3 million in 1902. By 1913, Canada was importing from the United Kingdom goods to the value of £23.795 million. Similar results were obtained in New Zealand, South Africa, and Australia, who followed the lead of the Premier Dominion in according preference unilaterally to imports from the United Kingdom. At the Colonial Conference in 1903, the Prime Ministers of self-governing colonies, as the Dominions were still called, resolved unanimously in favour of imperial preference and respectively urged on His Majesty's government the expedient of granting in the United Kingdom preferential treatment to the products and manufactures of the colonies, either by exemption or reduction of duties now or hereafter imposed. So he's arguing that this imperial preference was actually a great success, and it was good for Canada and it was good for Britain, okay, as against laissez-faire. But 3 years later, the cry of Big and Little Loaf contributed to the rout of the Unionist Party, whose leader, if that is the word, Arthur Balfour, went no further towards fiscal reform than the support of a policy of retaliation against foreign dumping. He would not agree to a general tariff. A less plutocratic and less innovative Conservative Party might have put forward a positive policy of tariff reform as a means to social reform at home. Imperial preference, comprehensive and reciprocal, would have assured materials and markets, greater opportunities of migration, stronger defences and imperial development on an American scale. It was thus the proper answer to the clamour of an increasing electorate for relief from unemployment and other hardships of their existence. Joseph Chamberlain was compelled to retire from active politics in 1906. The Conservatives continued disunited on tariff reform. The triumphant Liberals were united against it. As ever, according to Biggs Davison, the villainous, traitorous, supine, cowardly, disastrous Tories, yet again to blame. Social reform became a Liberal possession and that of the new Labour Party. Both radicalism and the socialism, which in great measure sprang from it, preferred the redistribution of existing, though diminishing, wealth to the establishment of an imperial fiscal system which would have enriched the whole empire and supported a complete edifice of social reforms. The early British socialists inherited from a Liberal Party a pathetic attachment to free trade, a pallid fear of greatness, and a hatred of annexations. To these negative ideas and sterile emotions, they added some of the theories and fallacies of Hobson and Lenin. The Great War produced the McKenna and other duties of the Corn Production Acts, a committee under Lord Balfour of Burley, appointed by Mr. Asquith, recommended the adherence of Great Britain to imperial preference. In 1919, Mr. Austin Chamberlain's budget made all existing custom duties preferential in favour of other parts of the empire. And it was not until the 1930s, when our largely obsolete economy was in ruins, when unemployment, class resentment, and underconsumption were rapidly alienating increasing numbers of industrial workers from the historic political parties, that Joseph Chamberlain's other son proudly installed a measure of imperial preference. Combined with the abandonment of the gold standard, it was enough to restore the national stability, reduce unemployment by millions, and lift not the sterling block alone, but the world out of depression into which it had been plunged by the blundering of bankers and the ignorance of men of state. I'll stop there. I mean, this book goes on, and every chapter is absolutely fascinating. But I thought that, you know, his account, basically, of those critical years of British decline there, and some of the mistakes that were made, you know, I just thought it was interesting from the point of view of some of the things we've been discussing recently, and in light of Scott Ritter's, in my view, inflammatory comments on that show the other day. All right, I hope this was interesting. Do pick up a course at the Academic Agency, Trivium. If you want to write like Biggs Davison, do Foundations of Writing, or maybe pick up Foundations of Shakespeare, and I'll see you all tomorrow. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.